Thank you, Oren. Our next speaker is Catherine Rankin from the University of Toronto.
Good morning. I also want to thank Margit and Neil for inviting me to this wonderful event and giving me the opportunity that to do something that I've wanted to do for a long time now, and that is to think about how the field of critical development studies might be tapped as a resource for developing the normative dimensions of planning theory. My work has straddled these two fields, and I've always found it quite remarkable that with some notable exceptions, and Peter Marcuse's work is among them, that planning theory and critical development studies have rarely engaged one another as critical resources or as sources of political insight, and that this disciplinary insularity persists in spite of the fact that both of these professional practices, planning and development, take as their object of study a profession that has a duplicitous relationship to capitalist accumulations as well as liberal notions of benevolent trusteeship. And what strikes me is that the analytical edge that critical development studies has over planning lies in its mandate to view liberal projects of improvement explicitly in relation to projects of empire, right? So that the bald entanglements of development in global geopolitics pose starkly for that field the continuities with the civilizing missions of 19th century colonialism and the ethical peril, right, of telling other people what to do in the name of modernization, progress, sustainability, and so forth. But at the same time, where development studies comes up thin, I think, is in exactly the challenge of praxis, right? How to be critical while also engaging with development in pursuit of social justice. And that reflexivity in relation to post-colonial geopolitics, which in development studies seems rather have to produce a reticence toward practice, an understanding of the role of the critic as properly distinct, as anthropologist Tanya Lee put it recently, from the role of the programmer. And since planning theory has generally kind of refused this distinction, I think that it's a useful venue in which to think about how to put critical development studies to good use. So my paper is organized around three themes shown here. And this first one is a domain that others in planning have probably addressed far more persuasively than I could. Of course, David Harvey has engaged debates about the ongoing development of underdevelopment to similarly link planning to the logic of capital accumulation and the management of crises. And Peter Marcuse himself, in the 2006 Antipode paper, took up Edward Said's Orientalism to make an important distinction, right, between actually existing globalization and the ideology of globalism that seeks to legitimate global capitalism all over all other possible trajectories of globalization. So we can think about planning's role in reproducing this popular legitimacy of globalism. For example, in the current enthrall with the creative city ideologies that represent the latest version of supply-side inducements to global capital, and Stefan spoke about that yesterday. So for Peter Marcuse, the political imperative for theory is to reveal the differences, right, between globalism and actually existing globalization for the sake of dismantling its ideology and developing a political strategy. I want to add one further resource to this repertoire here with the limits I have, and that's the notion of relational comparison identified by geographer Gillian Hart, developing a Gramscian interpretation of the post-colonial condition This approach rejects, right, the separation of pure theory from specific historical conditions, and it begins with a notion of place as porous points of connection within wider networks of socially produced space, Doreen Massey. And the task becomes one then of charting processes of interconnection to explore how multiple forces come together in practice, right, to produce particular dynamics or trajectories within cities. And this is illustrated really well within Hart Gillian's own work on the Taiwanese industrialist in South Africa. She has a book talking about how the widespread presence of Taiwanese in the South African agrarian regions had to do with land reforms that took place in Taiwan, providing the social wage to underwrite this kind of massive mobilization of Taiwanese peasant labor into the industrial sector of this post-colonial transitioning economy. So the displacements that she sees in South Africa are not just kind of natural processes of accumulation by dispossession, but are socially produced ones rooted in this very specific time-space conjuncture, right, that links rural Taiwan to South Africa, or rather rural South Africa to Taiwan. So in planning theory, I think there's an important political implication here, and that is the possibility that webs of interconnection among concrete places in the world can themselves become the foundation of critical practices and common politics and alternative trajectories. This is, of course, Cindy Katz's notion of counter topography. So while what goes on, by the way, of progressive responses to, someone said this the other night, progressive responses to globalization in Mexico or South Africa may not seem to matter so much in the United States or North America, I think we can turn this around to think about the possibilities for building strategic translocal relations or alliances, you know, within the profession, to think about possibilities for that might respond progressively to these kind of conjunctural relationalities. And I don't mean in a kind of naive best practices sense, right? But in the sense of how can the diversity of practices elsewhere help inform a theory about what can be done within conjuncturally specific structures of opportunity and constraint, right? And Jenny Robinson has written this book called Ordinary Cities recently that talks about this. Okay. Now, I also think we need to think about how this approach can help us think about the cultural political limits to neoliberal urbanism, okay? And Mark Peter, in this Antipode article, also predicts that the internal contradictions to actually existing globalization periodically burst out, right, as they are now. And we see that there's kind of organized or spontaneous reaction in the shifts in the U.S. electorate. And that's, of course, because an important unintended effect of neoliberal governmental programs is the production of social groups that share a common experience and have the potential to mobilize for change. I think that critical development studies offer some ways to think about possibilities here, right? I'd agree, actually, with Jackie Levitt's comments the other night about that the way people occupy positions of marginality is more complicated than saying that they're either discontent or deprived, and also that we need to think about the places and times in which the contradictions of hegemonic projects are not really apparent to people, like in Justice's Amsterdam, or the reality that people routinely make bargains with hegemony, even though they may recognize their own subjection to it. Or that when they do resist, they may do so covertly and individually and not as a movement. So I'm thinking here of all the work that's been done by James Scott, you may be familiar with it, and others to think about the multiple forms that resistance can take, right? To see the hidden transcripts, he says, or the offstage discourses through which subordinate groups express a critique of the powerful, and to think about how these can be kind of a foundational form of politics. Or others like Laila Abu-Lugod, I'm writing about Bedouin women's practices, raise complicated questions of agency. And I'm afraid I won't read the quote here. But it has to do with, how do you acknowledge women's agency in her case without misattributing something like feminist consciousness? And how do you avoid, on the other hand, resorting to concepts like false consciousness? So I think we can draw on these contributions from critical development studies to think about a role for planning in several ways. Okay, one is simply learning to read these modes of representation that convey nonconformity. And in that, I would say, is a mode of listening that rests not on the capacity of others to participate in liberal democratic venues, as the communicativists would say, but on the skills and the wills of the planner as something like an organic intellectual. This is my last remark. To say that I can all, I think we can think about a role for planning too in catalyzing, right, a kind of collective critical consciousness among those that might be engaged in these more individual or covert forms of resistance, and for generally sort of taking up the challenge to think about how to have change, societal-based change. I'm starting to do some work with a neighborhood organization in Toronto that's aiming to achieve what it's calling revitalization without displacement, drawing on the work of Vancouver planner Nathan Adelson. And I'm really, I'm struck and humbled by the enormity of the task of getting, you know, like the head of the local BIA to see his interests in common with the women's shelter down the street, which, you know, houses women, who many of whom are addicted to crack, and people see them as being the source of the bringing drug dealers into the neighborhoods, whose incomes depend on prostitution. And then again with the Sri Lankan immigrant who is who's just sort of seeing the neighborhood as an incubator for her to start, you know, a business. The political question about how you could forge a common ground like among these constituencies, I think, is crucial, right, for confronting the huge problem of gentrification. And for me, really the greatest resource for thinking about this core challenge for planning lies in transnational feminist contributions to critical development studies. I think here is where we can really think, sometimes quite painfully, about how to bring that notion of relational comparison home and into the practice of planning in a more reflexive way. And so these are procedural questions that engage diversity not in a way that would kind of bracket difference, but engage it politically. So I just want to quickly mention in this regard a wonderful book called Playing with Fire, written by a collective of women development workers in India and a geographer, Richa Nugger, where they recount a process of their kind of collective political conscientization where they relate to each other, you know, as a collective of workers, their childhood experiences, their experiences in marriage, their experiences as NGO workers, and in so doing, come to recognize how they have each differently kind of dragged the institutions of patriarchy and capitalism and casteism differently, sometimes resisting, sometimes bargaining with them, sometimes you know, being unaware of them. And this kind of intimate and painful process of historicizing their difference and questioning their positionality in relation to one another as they are delivering services to the poor, it helps, enables them to develop this powerful collective analysis of the violences of capitalism and casteism and so forth that then becomes the basis for them to challenge this the pan-Indian organization that they work for its own kind of discriminations, which ultimately becomes the basis of a whole social movement in India for thinking about the nature of the development enterprise. So I think a key point of the story is that beginning with the personal, right? And I don't mean in a visceral sense, but in this kind of relational sense, created the possibility for building new solidarities across differences out of which could emerge stronger theorizations about universal concerns and, in fact, new political subjectivities that are able to engage in critical activism. So, you know, I think it's overwhelming, right, to think about this from the perspective of a planning practice. But I also think that it's imperative to do so for the sake of, you know, harnessing diversity to the critique of actually existing globalization, right? I think a praxis of collaboration produces critiques that are more potent because they might be formulated more potent than ones that you develop within a planning institution or academia, because they encompass knowledge that's situated in the experience of people who are marginalized, right? So at the very least, I think this kind of praxis of collaboration requires a shift in the criteria for judgment about what would be good planning, right? And that it must not just accurately and authentically represent exclusions or make a good case for the right to the city, but what is equally significant politically is the possibility that theory making itself could constitute individual and collective agency in the service of activism. Thanks.